I'd like to ask you to open the New Testament to Matthew chapter 19. Read from there in just a moment. Matthew 19. As our lives as husband and wife begin, when we stand before God and before our fellow man, and we commit ourselves to another human being for life, I believe we're engaged in one of the most noble acts that a human spirit in this life can be involved in. Marriage is a divine arrangement. It is something that God has provided for the welfare of mankind as a whole, but provided also for the growth and the development of each individual who enters into this covenant. And I'd like to suggest to you that the lifetime expectation of this relationship is not a lifetime sentence. It is not merely something to endure. It is not an obligation merely to keep, but rather marriage is a divine arrangement designed to bring out the very best in the individuals who are so committed to one another. And I think we should look at this commitment as a gift from God, not a burden from God. And that we should then apply ourselves, as we spoke of this morning, applying ourselves to the hard work of marriage to enhance the relationship that we have taken on with our husbands, with our wives, to grow in that relationship, to nurture that relationship, to vow to behave in that relationship as brethren in Christ, as Peter says in 1 Peter 3, as heirs together of the grace of life. In Matthew chapter 19, in verse 5, Jesus is going back to the original creation of man and the institution of this covenant, and says, for this reason, in Matthew 19:5, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So then they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God is joining together, let not man separate. When we make those vows, and we spoke of the difference this morning between the wedding and the marriage, and that the hard work of making this relationship work comes later than the wedding, still something very significant is taking place in that ceremony. What was formerly two, Jesus says, now becomes one flesh. This is a one flesh union or melding or joining of two souls that were independent and individual. And what Jesus says in verse 6 of Matthew 19, it becomes an indivisible whole. What was two now becomes one. And what formerly might have been done by one on his own or her own, now might be destructive to the one flesh unity. And so we do not have now two independent wills, two independent souls, merely living in an agreement. But we have two now become one, indivisible. And what two people are doing in that moment of time before God is pledging exclusive love. And usually there's some terminology to that effect in any wedding ceremony. Exclusive love, support for one another, in sickness and in health, richer or poorer, something to that effect. That is, I will be supportive. I will be strengthening. I will seek to uphold you and be your companion in whatever circumstance may come to us in this life. And I'll tell you, people enter into that covenant not seeing what may come, and that's, I suppose, a good thing. If we could look down the road and see what all was in store for us 10 or 15 or 20 years down the way, how frightening would that be? But nonetheless, whatever it is, we're vowing to endure. The only way we're going to keep that vow is if the marriage is founded on God, which is where we started this morning. We don't know what's coming down the road. And I don't want to at all treat that lightly. What can come down the road can be pretty horrible. But if God is my strength, and I vow to love God first and then my mate, I am building the foundation for whatever comes down the road. And that I will continue to love and support my mate. And I will express fidelity to them throughout life. That is, we vow, I will not abandon you for another. To be able to have that kind of confidence in a relationship brings tremendous joy and peace. It is a wonderful thing to be loved by someone who you have all confidence is loyal to you. But when we make that vow, as we said in a sermon not too long ago on change, we bring our personal honor into the picture. We were talking a few weeks ago how difficult it is to change what we are. And we never seem to really vow that we're going to take control of this element of our lives and change it for the good, because if we make that kind of a vow, then we bring our personal honor into the picture. And now if I eat too many brownies or whatever it is I've now broken my vow on, I have to consider my character and the violation of my honor. But we bring our honor to the table here when we vow to be loyal exclusively and love through this life that person that we're now entering this relationship with. Our character is at stake. We bring our honor to bear, as we say, before God and these witnesses. This is what I'm going to be, this is what I'm going to do, and I will not forsake you for another. In Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and verse 5, Solomon says, it is better not to vow than to vow and not pay. Don't make the commitment, don't make the promise, don't make the vow if you're not intent upon and determined to keep it. Because to break a vow that you make before God is a serious matter. And that is demonstrated various places in the Scriptures. And so, with marriages crumbling all around us in society, in fact, in being gone for the last week, I heard more than one story of a marriage breaking up of the sort that you said to yourself, I never thought they would break up. I never thought that wife would walk out on her husband and children. And yet we hear stories like this over and over of people we know, of people we don't know very well, but certainly the stories are not few and scattered. With the state of marriage as it is all around us, we should be wary of anything that weakens our resolve to love our spouse as we vowed, or create distance between us and our spouse. And some of the remedy for that we've spoken of in the lesson this morning. Tonight, with, I suppose, some regret or sorrow, we're going to be dealing with some more negative elements of the marriage relationship, and particularly when marriages break up. And I hope that perhaps there's something we can offer in the study that might help us to focus more clearly on what is at stake when the time may come that we consider in our minds not keeping those vows and breaking the commitments that we've made. I want to look at Malachi chapter 2. If you don't exactly know where that one is, it's the last book in the Old Testament. Sometimes they kind of all run together, the minor prophets. In Malachi chapter 2, we have this observation regarding divorce. Again, as you're turning there, let me suggest the covenant under which this is said is immaterial. This is not an Old Testament precept. It is an eternal precept regarding God's view of things because of the moral issues that are attached to it. Malachi chapter 2, beginning in verse 14, and God is in this book enumerating the sins of the people, pointing out their faults. And the people are protesting in reverse. That's what's said at the beginning of verse 14. The people protest against God. For what reason? Because the Lord has been witness between you and the wife of your youth, with whom you have dealt treacherously, yet she is your companion and your wife by covenant. But did He not make them one, having a remnant of the Spirit? And why one? He seeks godly offspring. Therefore take heed to your spirit, and let none deal treacherously with the wife of his youth. For the Lord God of Israel says that He hates divorce, for it covers one's garment with violence, says the Lord of hosts. Therefore take heed to your spirit, that you do not deal treacherously. Divorce, the breaking of covenant, the abandonment of a spouse, always rests on violence and treachery in one form or another. It is the wrongdoing against another human being, and not just that, but in reference to the most devout covenant that we can make in this world. And we pledge ourselves through life, and we pledge ourselves through whatever circumstance may come, and we stake our honor on it, and we do it before God. And then if the time comes when we tire of that situation, we're bored with it, our eye is caught by someone else, we just want something different in life, we now enter into a realm of treachery and deep hurt against one who rightfully should have expected our faithfulness because we promised it. Divorce is the dashing of hope. No longer can the future be looked to with confident and joyous expectation. Now the future is going to be filled with doubt and uncertainty. And if children are involved, how are we going to be parents? What effect will it have on my child? What about my own future? Where am I going to be, especially in the case of a woman and a mother who's left by her husband? Divorce is the ruin of joy. Even if you may be the innocent party, as Jesus speaks of in Matthew 19, even if you have kept your fidelity and honored your commitment, but if you're the one who has been abandoned by an unfaithful mate, it is still the ruin of joy. Those who have been so treated do not jump up and click their heels and say, goody for me, I'm the innocent party. It is misery. It is heartache. It is rejection. It is sorrow. And I think it is probably little solace to most people that they may have an option out there in the future of remarriage if, in fact, their mate has been unfaithful to them, as Jesus says. That may be an option, but it is not a joyous thought, I do not believe, to most people who go through divorces. Divorce is rejection. It's the temptation to bitterness. It's anxiety about life. It's betrayal, poverty, abandonment, a flood of emotions that torment our soul and replace everything good with nearly everything bad. This is why God hates it. This is why He says it's filled with treachery. And He says, I do not want you to so deal with the wife of your youth, speaking primarily to the males in that cultural context. When two people vow themselves to faithfulness to each other before God, at least one of them, if not both, is condemned when divorce occurs. It is the utter failure of character and godliness. And there's nothing good to say about it. But I want to go one step further and deal with a most unpleasant companion of divorce, if I can call it that. And that is, we must consider in this discussion of what happens when marriages fail, we must consider the near omnipresence of adultery in this process. I don't have any statistics before me. I'm just simply going to make a comment out of personal experience. And feel free to do your own research. I'm sure somebody's got some facts and figures on this. My personal opinion is very, very few divorces occur in this country without adultery having been committed by either or both parties. I believe personally that it's rare, though it does happen, but I believe it's rare for divorce to occur without adultery also occurring somewhere in that process. In Hebrews chapter 13, among other places, we have a very, very clear statement by God concerning adultery, more specifically concerning adulterers. This gets very personal. It's not just that God is condemning some sin in some nebulous way, but He speaks very directly to the perpetrators. Hebrews 13:4, marriage is honorable among all. We've seen that hopefully in the lesson this morning. Marriage is honorable among all, and the bed undefiled, but fornicators and adulterers God will judge. The same sort of thing is said in 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 9, where adulterers are mentioned in a list of others who are immoral or ungodly, and Paul says such people will not enter the kingdom of heaven. It's very, very plainly stated, not only how God feels about divorce, but how God feels about adultery. And yet, people are deceived into practicing it. Even people who, on the one hand, would know better by their study of the Word of God or by their life as a Christian. And yet, it's committed. And sometimes it's committed apparently without any pang of conscience whatsoever. Again, as I've just recently heard of a young woman who simply walked away from her husband and children, determined to live for herself. And someone, by all accounts, would have been thought to be a Christian. Fornicators and adulterers God will judge, but our culture continues to insist that adultery is natural. It's just part of being a human being. It's part of being a sexual creature. It's part of the evolutionary process. And the attempt simply to make it morally neutral. Adultery is glorified in magazines and throughout our pop culture. And I think this, in turn, not just for the treachery that is done in the act of adultery and then divorce, but it creates a jaded and fatalistic view of fidelity and longevity in marriage. In other words, we come to assume as a society, marriage cannot be for life. It can't possibly be for life because I see so few examples of it around. And so it changes the mindset of a generation. Outside of the treachery that's done in the individual circumstance, it begins to tell people either, number one, well, adultery must not be that bad, divorce must not be that bad because everybody around me is doing it, or the opposite, it might delay people from wanting to enter into the covenant because they don't trust anyone. This is just simply seen to be the way it is in life. Adultery does not usually occur early in a marriage, and yet, having said that, I sort of have to put a little asterisk by that. I'm hearing of more and more situations where it is occurring early in the marriage. Generally speaking, I think it tends to be something that develops over time and is the end of a process. But that does not mean that adultery certainly cannot happen early. And I can list a few people, as I'm sure you can too, who have been abandoned early in their marriage by an adulterous mate. But I'm going to be very brief in this part of the lesson because it's really going to draw on what I said this morning. But we talked about several things in the lesson this morning that are a part of making marriage work, of building relationship foundations to the marriage, relationship with our husband and wife that even mirrors the relationship we have with God. But I want to look at these just very briefly in a negative sense for the lesson tonight. We talked about how a good marriage should promote emotional fulfillment. But I think one of the foundation blocks for adultery is emotional neglect. I think the act of adultery usually comes at the end of a process that's been developing for a while. And one of those trends that's a bad trend in a marriage is emotional neglect. And let me say, in my opinion, I think generally this is the problem of a man toward his wife. 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7 encourages Christian husbands to dwell with their wives according to understanding. And I don't mean to be funny, but that's a big challenge. We are challenged to try to understand what makes our wife tick. Why she sees things the way that she does. Because very often it's going to be quite different than the way I'm going to view things. There are just some things, as a male, or maybe as a peculiar male, okay, I'll confess, I don't necessarily need in a relationship to make me feel one way or the other. But I'm sure it's totally different with my wife. And you know, this is a real hard sermon to preach with your wife sitting on the second pew. But there must be an attempt somewhere, somehow, by we insensitive males to try to understand what our wives need and not simply say, I don't need that, I don't know why you do. Dwell with our wives according to understanding. What happens is when that does not happen, when it does not occur, and that emotional fulfillment and satisfaction is not a part of that foundation for a good, strong marriage, gradually over time, our wives' affections for us are extinguished. When she's disappointed and disappointed and disappointed, and time after time after time, and perhaps has tried to tell us what she needs, and we just don't seem to hear it, because we don't need it. Over time, the affection can be doused. And so emotional neglect, together with the neglect of physical intimacy, which we talked about from 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 5, creates weaknesses, cracks, fissures in the foundations of our marriage. And we talked from 1 Corinthians 7 about the fact that we must not deprive, defraud, or denounce each other over legitimate physical desires and needs which God has placed within each of us and to varying degrees within various individuals. So it's not a matter, should not be, of ridicule. Physical gratification is part of God's plan to bind two individual people together into one whole. It's not merely a physical act. It occurs on an emotional level as we share that kind of intimacy with one another. And two people, by that process in part, not in whole, but in part, are being bound together in a very, very tight unity. People who share the most intimate and joyous and God-given things together are building and growing that oneness. And those that forsake it are not. And so emotional neglect and physical neglect become weaknesses in marriage. And I perhaps may be unfair in saying so, and if so, I'll apologize. But I do believe, whereas the former, the emotional neglect, most of all rides on the shoulders of men, I believe this one rides on the shoulders of women. In either of those statements, I don't mean to be unkind. I'm just trying to understand who and what we are as males and females. But I believe the physical neglect, more often than not, rests on the shoulders of a wife. Too tired, too distracted with the children, too dismissive of her husband's needs. We cannot neglect one another and then wonder what happened when satisfaction is found elsewhere. We also talked about friendship in the lesson this morning, and the neglect of friendship, again, creates weaknesses in the foundation of a marriage, perhaps leading eventually to adultery. And let me say, I believe that adultery most often is not a result just of physical desires. It's the satisfaction of emotional desires and friendship needs that one finds in somebody else, which naturally leads down the same path as it did with our mate, to physical satisfactions. But the nagging faults and frustrations of any marriage can obscure the deeper concepts of sacrifice and companionship and friendship, the fact we're on, if we're two Christians, a heavenly journey, a spiritual journey. And so if the friendship is neglected, the physical needs are neglected, the emotional satisfaction is neglected, we have set ourselves up for vulnerability and either ourselves or our mate becoming unfaithful, and both of us then in the aftermath wondering what happened. It might leave other people saying, as we might say of them, I never thought they would be divorced. I never thought he would do that. I never thought she would do that. And yet, how many times are we going to say that before we believe this can happen? We keep saying it, don't we, about people we know? We should take warning in this, brethren. It happens. It happened to elders and preachers and deacons and everybody else scattered throughout the Lord's body. There's no immunity for us in this, which is why we need to be working to build strong marriages and strong commitment. In the last part of the lesson, I want us to look at some of adultery's rationalizations, because I believe oftentimes when this happens, especially among Christians, those people walk right into adultery feeling justified. And that's shocking to me. But when people are confronted for their adultery, sometimes there's sorrow and contrition and confession. But in my experience, what I've seen more than anything is a desire to rationalize it and to protect it and defend it. And so there are some, I think, who use the victim mentality or fall into the victim mentality. I deserve it. I've been neglected. I've been mistreated. They didn't do this for me. They didn't do that for me. I've lived X number of years in this circumstance. I deserve the joy that I got from that relationship. That is a heart deceived by the devil. You deserved to be separated from God because your mate treated you badly? What sense does that make? You see, that person's only looking at adultery from one point of view, gratification. Not from the point of view, I had just left the Lord. What kind of reward is that for having been mistreated? Okay, so you've been mistreated. Your reward is to be separated from God because of adultery? That is total foolishness. And that is Satan talking, getting us to look at this only in one way. The vindictive mentality. They deserved it for what they did to me. And I'll tell you when this happens. When one has committed adultery, the other one goes out oftentimes and does the same, and they think they're paying them back. There have been many cases, unfortunately, over the past years that I've had to deal with this sort of thing. And the more you dig, and the more you ask questions, and the more information comes to light, it seems, again, almost fairly rare that only one has committed adultery. If you ask enough questions, oftentimes the second one will say, yes, I did it too, and I did it to get back at them. Again, that's a way to get back at someone? To cut yourself off from God by immorality? The love mentality basically says, I can't help myself, I love her. I love him. I can't stop what's happening. We just fell in love. Well, you know, I mentioned infatuation earlier in the lesson. That's what that is. Especially you got now two people that are married. Here's husband and wife, you know, A, and here's husband and wife B, and husband and wife from A and B get together, and they love each other, as if that justifies now breaking up two homes and destroying the sense of security and well-being of perhaps two sets of children. Two mates are abandoned. And the justification for all that is they love one another? No, they're lusting for one another. That's what it is. That's as far as it goes. They're lusting for one another. Oh, they might be able to communicate. They might have elements of friendship. They might have things in common. But the bottom line of we love each other really is more physical. And it, as if love justifies all treachery that's done. Well, there's the famous midlife crisis mentality. She makes me feel young again. And this often is on the shoulders of the man. It's the man who has lost sight of himself and seeks for who he is, so he might say, in some pretty young thing at the office or at the gym. And she makes me feel young. My wife doesn't make me feel this excited about life and filled with vitality. This is just ego run wild is what this is. It's about me. I feel good about myself. She makes me feel good about myself. And I tell you, the midlife crisis thing is just simply someone sensing that life is passing them by and they're not focused on the fact that eternity is getting nearer. And so eternity is sacrificed for a momentary sense of finding out who I am. But you know what the problem of that is? Why hasn't this man been finding out who he is in the sight of God for the last 30 years? He apparently has not built anything spiritually in regard to his identity, his purpose, his satisfying the will of God, his relationship with God. None of that has been sacrificed. You see, it all comes back to loving God more than our mate. Here's a man now that really has no relationship with God. So he's looking for who he is in a red sports car convertible with a pretty young blonde by his side. As if that tells him who he is. Well, it may tell him who he is, all right, but who he thinks he is not who he really is. If that's how he's defining himself. These are just lies of the devil that people fall into time after time after time. The honesty mentality. Well, I never really loved her. I never really loved him. And there's this sense of trying now to do the honorable thing by owning up and saying, well, I never loved her. I never loved him. So I'm going to cast them free now in my honesty and pursue whichever course I want to pursue. Let me tell you, the honorable thing is not to stand up and crow, you never loved them. The honorable thing is to do what you vowed you would do, and that's love them to the day that you die. That's the honorable thing. And that's the thing that we who are married vowed before God that we would do. All of these things tend to obscure the truth. The truth about adultery. The truth about divorce. The truth about the treachery of it all. The truth about what it does to the children. The truth about what it does to the innocent person. The truth about what it does to the guilty person. Adultery and divorce is the big lie. It is trading reality for a fantasy or an illusion. It's the promise that no one will find out. I just heard while I was away a man who is a preacher of the gospel and a teacher in a school somewhere has been arrested for sexual improprieties with students. I hope in time that charge proves to be false. But let me tell you, it happens all the time. And it happens because, in part, we think nobody will find out. It's on my computer. Who's going to find out? Well, they've confiscated his computers. Somebody is going to find out the truth about that situation. Nobody will get hurt. The lie obscuring the truth. It's never too late for us to say, I'm sorry. I haven't devoted to this marriage what I should have. I've not done my part in founding it on a spiritual foundation. And from this point on, I'm going to devote myself to you in the way that God says that I should. Because I realize that to do otherwise is to fall prey to Satan. And is to ultimately destroy my honor, my character, my relationship with God, and you, my mate. It is never too late for us to take a stand, dig in our heels, and say, I'm going to do what I vowed to the Lord X number of years that I was going to do. Marriage has great power to bring joy and security, companionship, happiness, and even spiritual enrichment. But it does not happen automatically. It does not happen by itself, which is what we've been trying to say in the lessons today. It happens through hard work and through people who are first of all devoted to God, then devoted to each other, according to the lifetime covenant of marriage that God says is for our good. And I hope we've enhanced the understanding of that covenant by the things we've shared today. Divorce is a bad thing, which we've said in the marriage. But if you're not what you ought to be in the sight of God, there's a spiritual divorce of sorts coming. There's going to be eternal separation from God if you go to face Him with your life not as it should be in His sight. We're going to sing a song to encourage you, to inspire you, to help you to think about yourself before God, and for you to ask yourself, where are you? How sound and secure are you in your relationship with God? Or are you unfaithful to Him so that in the day of judgment, He will say, depart from me, I never knew you. He'll divorce us for eternity away from His presence. What a horrible fate for being selfish in this life and deciding to live life the way we choose to live it. There's a soul here tonight who wants to submit themselves to the will of God and becoming a child of His, or in repenting of sin and returning to Him. Then as we stand and sing this song, we invite you to come. Let us help you if we can.